proceed to the second case, Dennis versus Dunlap.
This is the 15 minutes.
Right. But we'll make it. We'll be a little shorter. Okay. Mr. White.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric White. I'm an assistant attorney general. I represent the defendants, appellants, Wayne Dunlap and Peter Thomas. This is a case where the district court substituted its judgment for that of a jury. After the jury found in favor of the defendant, the district court did something that courts almost never do, or very rarely. It overturned the jury verdict. It granted judgment as a matter of law and conditionally granted a new trial. But what makes this case really remarkable is the weakness of the district court's reasoning. In granting judgment as a matter of law, the district court relied on very little evidence, virtually no evidence. And in sua sponte, conditionally granting a new trial, the court relied on a rationale that it sua sponte found that was not argued by Mr. Dennis in his post-trial motions. Before addressing the award of judgment as a matter of law, it's important to remember the precise issue. The issue is taking all the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendants and all reasonable inferences from that evidence. Could any reasonable jury have found that this authorization for release of information did not extend to medical records? Although the jury was told by the judge to determine whether or not the authorization extended to medical records, it was not given any guidance by the judge. It was not told that it should look at the party's subjective intent. It was not told that it should look solely at the words of the authorization. It was simply told, decide whether or not this document extends to medical records. Because the jury was not given any guidance, it's difficult to see how its verdict could be deemed unreasonable. If, for example, the jury followed Illinois contract law and looked at the party's subjective intent, then under that theory, the jury's verdict was reasonable because there was no evidence in the record as to what the parties intended by this authorization. In fact, the district court refused to allow Colonel Dunlap to testify as to his intent in tendering this authorization. He was not allowed to say why he adopted the authorization in the first place, at least what he intended the information, he was not allowed to testify what information besides the criminal history that he intended that authorization to extend to. But we know from an offer of proof at trial that if he had been allowed to testify, that he would have testified that he did not intend for the authorization to extend to medical records. In fact, he testified in the offer of proof that he did not even know what the National Personnel Records Center was, and he certainly didn't know whether or not the NPRC maintained medical records. Nor was there any evidence in the record as to what Mr. Dennis thought the authorization concerned, or at least there was no evidence that he thought it concerned medical records. At the time that it was tendered to him, he did not tell anyone at the Lincoln's Challenge Program that he thought that this was unconstitutional because it extended to medical records. At trial, he did not testify that one of the reasons he refused to sign the authorization was because he believed it extended to medical records. And indeed, he admitted on the witness stand that the first time the issue of medical records even came up was as a result of this court's decision in the first appeal in this case. Given this admission and viewing it in the light most favorable to the defendant, the jury certainly could have concluded that neither of these parties intended this authorization to extend to medical records. Now, even if it were appropriate to ignore the party's intent and to look solely at the words of the authorization, the authorization was not clear on its face. Nowhere on the face of the authorization does it mention the words medical records, nor does it say anything synonymous like health records, doctor's records, hospital records, anything like that. So under well-recognized principles of Illinois principles of contract construction, an ambiguous document is construed narrowly against the drafter. In this case, the drafter was Lincoln's challenge program. Construing that document narrowly would have involved restricting the rights of the Lincoln's challenge program to access its employees' information and expanding the rights of privacy of the employees. Another rule of contract construction is that contracts are to be construed so as not to include unlawful or unconstitutional terms. And I cited a Third Circuit case as supplemental authority where it involved a very similar authorization, and in an administrative decision, the Secretary of Labor construed it expansively, holding that the employer in that case had unconstitutionally violated the employee's rights. And the Third Circuit said, this is Doyle versus Secretary of Labor, 285-243. Third Circuit said that the Secretary of Labor should not have construed it expansively, that it should have construed it narrowly to avoid any unconstitutional construction. These rules of contract construction simply confirm the reasonableness of the jury's verdict. Finally, even if it were appropriate to look solely at the language and to ignore these rules of contract construction, the jury could reasonably have focused on what records were at the National Personnel Records Center during the life of the authorization. Remember, the authorization was good for a period of 1 year. The authorization was tendered to Mr. Dennius in August of 96, and it had, by definition, by its own terms, it was only good for 1 year. The evidence that Mr. Dennius presented was that on the day before trial, on April 30th, 2001, he was able to obtain his medical records from the National Personnel Records Center. The jury was not required to conclude that this authorization, which was only good for 96 through 97, extended to medical records based on that evidence. The jury reasonably concluded that this authorization did not extend to medical records. Now, the district court also overturned the jury's verdict by conditionally awarding a new trial. The court gave two reasons for doing this. First, the court said that the decision was against the manifest weight of the evidence. And second, the court came up with its own theory that Mr. Dennius had not argued, namely that a remark by defense counsel in closing argument was sufficiently prejudicial that it warranted a new trial. Neither of these justifications is warranted. Because of the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial, the standard for overturning a jury verdict is appropriately high, and this court reviews a decision by the district court sort of on an elevated abuse of discretion standard. It will affirm if there was a miscarriage of justice, if the jury's verdict was a miscarriage of justice, or if it would shock the conscience. Neither of these standards applies. First, there was no evidence regarding what the parties intended. There was no evidence about what the National Personnel Records Center was. There was no evidence about what its holdings were. The only evidence was that at one day before trial, Mr. Dennius was able to obtain his records from that institution. But there was certainly nothing about its holdings during the life of the authorization. So I would argue that the court's decision, the jury's verdict, was not against the manifest weight of the evidence. Second, the court came up with its own theory that defense counsel's remark was sufficiently prejudicial to warrant a new trial. But the remark in question was quite brief. It was about five sentences out of a defense closing argument that spanned 17 pages of transcripts. The argument was not inflammatory. Defense counsel essentially said that he asked the jury to keep in mind that the lawsuit was against Colonel Dunlop personally and not against the government, which was true. Defense counsel did not harp on the fact. He did not suggest that it would ruin Colonel Dunlop financially if there was a verdict against him. The most telling, of course, is that Mr. Dennius did not object to this remark. And indeed, the district court at the time did not see fit to admonish defense counsel that this was out of line. Indeed, as I've indicated, Mr. Dennius did not even argue in his post-trial motion that this was the basis for granting a new trial. Now, if there was any possible prejudice from this brief remark, the jury's instructions cured that prejudice. The jury was told it could consider only the evidence presented at trial. It was told that the remarks of counsel are not evidence, and that it should not be swayed by prejudice or sympathy. Under these circumstances, the court erred, abused its discretion in conditionally granting a new trial, and the verdict should be reinstated. Now, not only did the district court err in overturning the jury's verdict, it erred by even letting the case get to the jury in the first place. And there are two reasons why the defendants were entitled to judgment as a matter of law. First, Mr. Dennius made no showing that the alleged violation in question caused his injuries. Any Section 1983 plaintiff has to make three basic showings. First, he's got to show that the defendant owed a duty to the plaintiff. Second, he must show that the defendant breached that duty. And third, he must show that that breach of duty caused the plaintiff's injury. Here, Mr. Dennius did not show that by requiring Mr. Dennius to disclose his medical records, that caused him to refuse to sign the authorization. He did not complain at the time that medical records concerned him. He did not go to Mr. Dunlop and say, "Hey, I'm concerned about medical records." He testified on the witness stand that the issue came up as a result of this is the court's decision in Dennius 1. He was unable to say on the witness stand that the requirement that he disclose his medical records is what caused him to refuse to sign the authorization. For these reasons, the plaintiff failed to show causation, even if there was a constitutional violation, and the defendants were entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Secondly, Director Dunlop was entitled to qualified immunity. He was entitled to judgment as a matter of law because no reasonable official in his position would have understood that by requiring Mr. Dennius to sign this authorization, he was thereby violating his right to privacy in his medical records. It certainly was not patently obvious that that's what he was doing. If you look at the face of the authorization, nowhere does it say medical records. This court in Dennius 1 had the authorization before it. It could not tell whether or not the authorization extended to medical records. And indeed, the case went back to the jury. The jury had the authorization before it. The jury heard all of the evidence. And not only did the jury was not able to find that it extended to medical records, it found that it did not extend to medical records. So it's hard to see how Colonel Dunlop was unreasonable when he looked at it and he didn't think it extended to medical records. Nor is Dennius able to show that Colonel Dunlop should have done more investigation to determine whether or not it did extend to medical records. He does not cite any closely analogous case law involving ambiguous release forms. He does not cite any case law establishing a duty on the part of persons in his position to conduct an investigation of legal consequences of such a form. It certainly was not clearly established that Colonel Dunlop's conduct, the precise conduct in question, was unconstitutional. Finally, I'd like to talk about the injunction that the court issued against Director Thomas. Director Thomas, as you recall, succeeded Director Dunlop in the year 2000. The injunction was erroneous in this case because the 11th Amendment bars federal courts from enjoining state officials except to end a continuing violation of constitutional rights, or, as this court has held, to prevent an impending violation of constitutional rights. In this case, there's clearly no continuing violation. In August 2000, after this court's decision in Dennius 1, the Lincoln's Challenge Program allowed Mr. Dennius to return to work. They did so unconditionally. He was not required to sign any authorization whatsoever. So clearly there was no continuing violation, nor was there an impending violation. Recall that he was allowed to return to work in August of 2000. By the time of trial, in May 2001, he still had not been required to sign any authorization. So it's hard to see how there was an impending violation. Moreover, Director Thomas was not the person who required the authorization in the first place. He was the deputy director in 1996, and the testimony was that it was Dunlop. It was his sole decision to require the employees to sign the authorization. So what the district court did was enjoin a person who had never violated Mr. Dennis's rights and who vowed on the witness stand that he would never use that authorization again, and who had allowed Mr. Dennis to return to work without any condition. There was no impending violation to enjoin. Unless the court has any questions, we'd like to ask that the court reinstate the jury verdict and vacate the order against the injunction against Director Thomas and his successors.
Thank you, Mr. Light.
Thank you.
Mr. Heller.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Heller. I represent the plaintiff, Ron Dennis. The plaintiff in this case was fired by the defendant because he would not sign an authorization to release his personal information, the authorization which this court described as a sweeping disclosure requirement. Defendants, through the time of trial, after remand, continued to use a third version of this form, which authorized the release of any information that any agency maintained on an employee. All the while, the defendant never advanced any reason for needing this broad scope of information. In the first appeal, this court determined that the defendant was liable for damages to the extent that the authorization provided for the release of medical records and communication. The release specifically provides for the release of all records of the National Personnel Record Center, the U.S. Veterans Administration, employment and pre-employment records. It is undisputed that the plaintiff had been an employee of the Armed Services and that in the course of that employment over almost 20 years had gone through numerous medical exams and medical treatments with the Armed Services. It was undisputed at trial that in fact the National Personnel Record Center had Mr. Dennis's military records of his health medical records. Now the defendant argues that it was incumbent upon the plaintiff to prove that those specific records were specifically in custody of the National Personnel Record Center in 1996. That is not what this court remanded for a determination. The determination was, and the liability was, if the release provided for the release of medical records and communications. We in fact know, the elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about, is that there is no question at all that the National Personnel Record Center would have had and be expected to have Mr. Dennis's medical records. That is what that agency exists for. There's no dispute of that whatsoever. The trial court initially was going to instruct the jury taking judicial notice of that fact, and later determined that that was redundant, that it was sufficient, that plaintiff had proved that in fact the National Personnel Record Center had his medical records. If in fact they hadn't had his medical records, they had to be somewhere, whether his military records, whether they were with the VA or otherwise with his employer, and so they were still covered under that release form. But more to the core of the issue is what was the character of the right that was at issue. And we argue that it was Mr. Dennis's right to refuse to consent to this form.
Would have made any difference if they couldn't find the records?
No, it shouldn't have made any difference at all. And I'll give you the analogy that I thought of this morning is, what if they had conditioned his employment on him giving a complete consent to search his automobile at any time, no matter where it was at? It would have made no difference whether he owned an automobile or not. That would be an unconstitutional condition to put on someone's employment if you had no reason to look at his automobile. The fact is that there was a constitutional right that he was being required to give up as to consent to this search, or to give up his records and his privacy in his records in condition for his job. And there was no rationale, and the defendants have at no time said they had a rationale for requiring this information. So I would agree with the court's question that the intent of the party, the state of Mr. Dennis's mind, they're all irrelevant. The question is, did the consent form require him to release medical records? And our contention would be is that when the form says that all the records of the National Personnel Record Center and the VA are to be released under that form, it could say all the records, including medical records, and that adds nothing to it, because the National Personnel Record Center is the legal repository for those records. That's where you expect them to be, and in fact, that's where they were at. And the defendant can produce nothing and suggest nothing to suggest otherwise. And it is an absurdity to simply ignore that fact. The jury had the fact of where, in fact, those records were at. The court had in front of it and took judicial notice, which it thought redundant, that is the official repository for those records. The authorization form, without question, included medical records on its face, because that's what the VA and the National Personnel Record Center maintain. Now, the defendant has argued that this court, on its remand, somehow suggested that it determined that you couldn't determine from the document whether those medical records were covered under the document. And I think that's true as far as it goes. It's simply because in the argument and in the briefs, there was no discussion of the parties as to what exactly the National Personnel Record Center was and what its job was and what kind of records it kept. That simply was not addressed before the court. It's not in the briefs, and so it is something that then was developed before the trial court, and again, which this court is free to take judicial notice of with the information that we have now provided. With respect to the issue of causation, I believe that ties in to the analogy to the consent to a search to his car, if you put that in there. It does not matter what Mr. Danius's reason was for not giving consent. Defendant has cited no case where a party's reason for not consenting to a search or surrendering a constitutional right was determinative as to whether that right was violated. We believe, in fact, and the defense counsel made a misstatement here, that Mr. Dennis was unable to say on the witness stand that he did not sign it due to medical records. In fact, when that question was posited to him, the trial court ruled that that was irrelevant, and correctly so. But in fact, in other testimony, Mr. Dennis said that he was aware that his medical records with the Armed Services would be at the National Personnel Record Center, but that his objection to signing this form was not specific to that. It was because it was so broad that it covered so many things. And defendant is trying to use that as somehow a defense to say that Mr. Dennis, well, he really didn't object to his medical records. Clearly, he did object to his medical records being released, but even so, we say that doesn't matter. The fact is, he would not consent. He would not sign this consent form that would have released all the records of the National Personnel Record Center where his medical records were kept, why he wouldn't sign that consent, whether he just didn't like Mr. Dunlap, he didn't like that form, that's all irrelevant. He refused to surrender that constitutional right. And the defendant had no legitimate reason to force him to surrender that right. With respect to the issue of qualified immunity, the defendants have muddied the water a little bit by continuously referring to the form as ambiguous. And therefore, the defendant didn't have any responsibility, who drafted the ambiguous form, to determine what those ambiguous terms mean. Now, I say that's highly questionable. That was totally in the control of the defendant. He takes the form and imposes it on an employee at danger of his job. That there's some responsibility on the part of the defendant in drafting that document to see that constitutional rights are protected. But beyond that, we'll concede that point for the purpose of argument. There is no ambiguity that the authorization form applied to all records at the National Personal Records Center and the VA and the employment records, which would include the armed services. There's no ambiguity there. It applies to all those records. From a qualified immunity standpoint, then, Mr. Dennis testified he didn't know what the National Personnel Records Center was, what records it kept, and he made zero effort to find out. Now, the qualified immunity inquiry is, was it objectively reasonable for him to assume that no medical records would be covered by those agencies listed, or was it objectively reasonable for him, knowing that he did not know what records were there, to make no effort to find out? And these were government agencies. It would not take a great deal of effort to find out what they do and what records they store. In fact, as we've shown the court, you can simply go to their website and find that information out. The defendant in his brief makes the argument, well, you know, we only had 45 days in which to try to put this new release form together. Well, that's questionable whether he had was limited to 45 days. But assuming that was the case, we're talking about a phone call or two to find out what kind of records are at these agencies. He didn't know. He didn't care. He made no effort to find out. Now, under qualified immunity, we would contend that that is not objectively reasonable behavior of a government manager who is putting a condition on an employee and says, you're fired if you don't release this information to me. That's just not objectively reasonable.
That form was originally drafted by the Illinois State Police, wasn't it?
That is where he obtained the form. That is correct. And he made his argument in the brief, which he did not state here, that because he got it from the state police, because he supposedly asked a lawyer about it, and supposedly a lawyer said it was okay, that therefore qualified immunity applies. But that is subjective evidence that normally is not allowed in determining qualified immunity, and we would argue that in fact Mr. Dunlap himself never testified about who he went to get information about what this meant or whether it was okay. In fact, the only evidence in the record was that he told Mr. Dennis that he had checked it out and talked to an attorney about it. Well, whether that was true, whether what he told the attorney, exactly what the attorney said back, we don't know. And so we would say that certainly it doesn't rise to the level of the inquiry necessary to determine whether the records, and he had responsibility to determine what records he was asking for. Because, and again, it is clear, it is without dispute, that he made no effort to find out what these specific agencies had. And And he didn't care to. It didn't matter. And it turned out he didn't really want those records anyway. The absurdity of arguing qualified immunity, it just doesn't fit here when what the defendant did was totally unreasonable. And it has to meet an objective, reasonable standard. And I will also note, as I've argued, that qualified immunity was waived. And this court tends to be reluctant to find qualified immunity waived, but there's particular reason to do so here, in that before the trial court, they argued qualified immunity, but what they argued, and the district court just summarily dismissed every time and appropriately, was that plaintiff had to show Mr. Dennis's intent to get medical records. Well, clearly qualified immunity did not require that we show such an intent. So they've changed their argument up here on appeal that, well, it's what the defendant could have reasonably known regarding what records this authorization covered. But that's a question of fact that should have been determined back at the trial court. They didn't ask the trial court to make that determination, and it's inappropriate for them to now ask this court to determine that factual question. And I've cited a couple of cases, the Berg case and one other case, where it was similar, where a qualified immunity issue turned on a question of fact, and the appellate court would not rule on it. And I would suggest that that would be appropriate here also. With respect to the injunction, a jury found that the defendant was likely to require plaintiff to sign a similar authorization form in the future. Now, the defendant now has argued in his brief that the jury didn't know about all the other problems with this authorization form and why the defendant wouldn't have used it. But of course, the defendant didn't ask the court to inform the jury of that fact. So they've waived any issue with respect to that. More importantly, the judge's decision to follow what the jury said and to determine that there was a probability that these defendants would again violate the plaintiff's right is clearly supported by the record. Not only the jury's finding, but the fact that the judge found it hard to believe the assertion by Mr. Thomas at the last minute that, in fact, he would never use this authorization again. Now, there's three different authorization forms at a minimum that are in the record. Which one he was talking about is not clear, number one. Number two, that statement by Mr. Thomas came right after the trial court said, why haven't you ever told me that you're not going to use this form again? So they trotted Mr. Thomas up to the stand for him to make that assertion. All the while, the second form, which is almost as bad as the first form, the only difference being was they took out the all the access to attorney records, but it still had everything else, financial records, the National Personnel Records Center with all the medical records. The second form was still months after this court's first decision. They were requiring employees to sign that second form, and it was still in the personnel records, had not been revoked of any of the current employees. And finally, Mr. Thomas told Mr. Dennis that first form and second form were going to be revised and every employee would have to sign a new form. Now, that was never contradicted in the record, that Mr. Thomas told Mr. Dennis that at the time Mr. Dennis was reemployed after this court's first decision, that there would be a new form that he would have to sign, that all employees would have to sign. Well, that new form, we still haven't seen that new form. We don't know what the status of that new form is. So with all that coming together, it certainly was not unreasonable for the court to determine that there was some likelihood that plaintiff's rights would again be violated. And I would note the court take a look at the form that was being used at the time of trial And it's that it's in the defendant's brief at Appendix 34. This is the third form that they claim they were only having new applicants sign. It has a first sentence that authorizes release of any information regarding a criminal record. The second sentence says, I further authorize any agency which maintains records relating to me to provide the same on request to Illinois State Police for the purpose of this investigation. Any records. It doesn't even narrow it to state government. Defendant might argue that that's what it means, but it doesn't say that. Any agency could be at least any government agency, state or federal, would include, again, clients' medical records, which they know they have no reason to ask for. And they continue to use, this was in use at the time of the second of the trial. And for them to argue that they've seen the error of their ways and that clearly the plaintiff was in no danger of being asked to sign an inappropriate form that was asking for information that they didn't have right to. I mean, the district court's skepticism and should also point out is that to the closing argument at trial, as the district court pointed out, the defendants tried to say that Mr. Dinius was in the wrong and engaged in wrongful conduct in not signing that release form. You know, and the district court said, you guys don't get it. You know, you are still not understanding the issue here and that this form is wrong by making this argument to the jury, which they made several times and was objected to, and the court ordered them to stop making that argument. But all that points out that the injunction was clearly appropriate. I have argued that if for some reason the court thinks that the injunction goes a little too far, the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear in the Steffel case that I argued that a declaratory judgment is somewhat less rigorous in what is required to sustain it, and that the reason the district court here didn't enter a declaratory judgment regarding that this form, that the first form was unconstitutional, because it felt that the injunction went and took care of everything. And so it would be redundant to have the declaratory judgment. But if this court for some reason would decide that the injunction was not sustained by the record, then it would be very appropriate to enter have the declaratory judgment entered to sustain the fact that these defendants have clearly not shown that they understand what the rights regarding privacy are. And I have cited the Vickery case, which the Seventh Circuit decided, where even though the district court there had said that it was unlikely that the defendants would violate the law again, they still hadn't made a clear enough statement, and therefore he was entering a declaratory judgment. And this court in Vickery sustained, in fact, it was the same district court judge, Judge Baker. And so we would ask you to consider that as an alternative if for some reason you think that the judgment injunction was inappropriate.
With regard to the injunction, how appropriate is it to base an injunction on comments about counsel, of counsel, with regard to the future conduct of defendants?
Well, the counsel stands before the court as the representative of the defendant. And I think it's quite appropriate in light of, if that was an isolated, then maybe you could discount that. But in light of the continuing conduct with this third form that they continued to use, with the fact that the second form was still in legal effect and in employees' files, for the defense counsel then to make arguments before the court that Mr. Dinius had engaged in wrongful conduct in not signing this form, I think it's certainly not out of the question to say that represented the position of the defendant and their attitude towards the issue. So I think I would argue that that was appropriate. Finally, I would note that the alternative argument that we've made to sustain the trial court's judgment on an equal protection ground, which I realize is new, but the defendant misconstrued the argument. The class is that the defendant treated Mr. Denius different from all other employees on an irrational basis because he didn't sign this form. It was a form they didn't need. That was an irrational classification under the law, and therefore he was treated differently and irrationally. We would ask that the court affirm the district court in all respects except for on the issue of emotional damages and the setting of attorney's fees, and with those two issues we would ask that the court remand for a new hearing as we've requested. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Mr. White.
Counsel says that the intent of the parties, Mr. Dunlop and Mr. Denius, is completely irrelevant. This was an authorization that was attached and made part of a contract, an Illinois contract. Under Illinois law, it is relevant what the parties intended by the words that they used. The jury was not instructed that they could not look at the parties' intent. In fact, the jury was not given any direction as to what principles it was to apply. So it's difficult to see how its decision was unreasonable. Counsel says that it's obvious that the National Personnel Record Center maintained medical records, but the problem is that they didn't adduce any proof at trial about that except for that one piece of evidence that Mr. Denius was able to get his records from that institution on the day before trial. They didn't bring in anyone to describe what the National Personnel Record Center is, what it does, how long it's been in existence, or anything of that nature. And it's when you have a jury trial, it's appropriate to bring forward evidence, even if you think that it's obvious. They rely on the attempt to take judicial notice of information that they downloaded from the Internet. At first, the judge did take judicial notice as they requested. And then later in the trial, the judge reversed himself and said, I'm not going to take judicial notice of these web pages that you've directed me to. The court referred to that ruling as pretty shaky in the first place. So Mr. Denius did not come forward with evidence as to what the National Personnel Record Center, or what it does, or what holdings it has.
What harm will the defendant suffer if the injunction is in place, Mr. White?
I'm not sure there is any harm, Your Honor, but as I indicated, this is an issue of the 11th Amendment and whether or not the court has the power to enjoin a state official. And Mr. Denius has not addressed that at all. There certainly was no continuing violation, and the argument that there is an impending violation is erroneous. Mr. Denius cites evidence not relating to himself. He cites the fact that the authorization remained in the personnel files of other employees. Well, that doesn't prove that the defendant was likely to require him to sign an authorization again.
Well, what about the third form?
Third form, again, that was the undisputed evidence that the third form was not being applied to existing employees, only new applicants. Mr. Denius is not a new applicant, so there's no basis to conclude from the third form that Director Thomas was likely to require Mr. Denius to sign any authorization. In addition, if you look at the third form, it does say any records, but then it says for the purposes of this investigation. Well, what is the investigation that the Illinois State Police was charged with doing? It says to look at one's criminal background. I don't have it right here.
Page 16 of your brief.
To release information relative to the existence or non-existence of any criminal record. And then It authorizes any agency which maintains records relating to me to provide the same on request for the purpose of this investigation. The investigation was to determine whether or not he had a criminal background. So even that's not clear. That
who keeps drafting these things, anyway?
Sorry?
Who keeps drafting these things?
I don't know who drafted that one. That's not in the record.
Can't blame this one on the state police?
I don't know. It's not in the record where that came from, Your Honor. Counsel suggests that I made a misstatement when I said that Dennis could not testify that one of the reasons he refused to sign the authorization was because of medical records. It's not a misstatement. He was asked by a defense counsel, weren't you interested in financial records? And he said that was something I was interested in. On redirect, counsel for Mr. Dennis could have asked him, well, Mr. Dennis, weren't you concerned about medical records as well? She didn't ask him that. As for qualified immunity, the question is, would a reasonable person have known that what he was doing by requiring Mr. Dennis to sign the authorization was violating his right to privacy in his medical records? Mr. Dennis says it's obvious, but it certainly wasn't obvious to this court, wasn't obvious to the jury, and he cites no case law suggesting that Mr. Dunlop acted unreasonably. Counsel suggests that it's unlikely that Mr. Dunlop actually showed this form to a lawyer, but that's the undisputed evidence. He showed the form to lawyers for the Department of Military Affairs, and they approved it. So it's not as if he did not conduct any investigation. Moreover, the issue is not waived. As I've indicated, the Supreme Court and this court have said that as long as a party has raised an issue in the trial court, it is not limited to the precise arguments that it made down below. That applies here because the defendant did make a qualified immunity argument before the district court. The district court identified the proper standard and thus put Mr. Dennis on notice that he did have to show what standard he had to meet in order to defeat our qualified immunity defense. Again, we ask that this court reinstate the jury verdict and vacate the injunction order. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. White. Ms. Leahy, Mr. Heller. Case is taken under advisement.